Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Screen Strong Families podcast, bringing you the best solutions for parents who are serious about eliminating screen conflicts in their home. This is Melanie Hempe, and welcome back to everyone who's been listening to us. And if you're new, we are so glad you found us. Probably you have found us over on our Facebook page and our Facebook group, Screen Strong Families. But if you haven't, be sure and check that out. So today, I am thrilled to be able to introduce you to a wonderful guest. She's a very, very good friend of mine. But before I introduce her, I just want to throw something out because I think that our guest is going to kind of like this little story, this little analogy. But we're all struggling with too much screen time in our kids. That's why you're here. This is why we exist at Screen Strong to help you figure this out. So there's this big digital dilemma. And most of y'all know that I have four children and I have dealt with this on a very personal level. And then also from my nursing background and from a medical viewpoint as well. But I have been thinking a lot about this lately and about how technology and the whole big internet out there is just really tough for kids to manage. And I want you to imagine, if you have kids, if you don't, you have seen this picture before of a toddler walking around in their dad's shoes, right? We've all seen these funny pictures. They're so cute and it's so funny and they can't walk. And no matter what we do, they're going to trip and they're going to fall. And, you know, it's really not going to be very funny when they hurt themselves. But the internet and our teens and our kids, it's the same thing. It's like toddlers walking around in shoes that are too big for them. So we have two choices. We can go with the culture and just try to train our kids to use the internet really well, but the internet's always going to be too big for them, right? And we can watch them get scarred and we watch them get scared. And we have our instincts and our parental instincts that are screaming, oh no, something's wrong. This doesn't fit. Or we have a second choice. And that's what we really support at Screen Strong. And that is to delay those big shoes of technology until our kids have a chance to grow into them. And what our focus needs to be is on helping them grow up well. And that is why I am so excited to have Chris Rowan, our guest today, on the show. And for you just to get to be introduced to her and to get to know her, she knows more about why these big shoes of tech don't fit our kids. She is an occupational therapist and a biologist, and she's from Canada. She has two wonderful websites, Zone In and the new one that's coming up, Balanced Technology Management, that's coming up. And we have both the links in our description. But Chris, I am so glad to welcome you. Welcome.
Thank you, Melanie. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, great. So I just have to say that Chris and I have been friends for a very long time. I was going to say that she was one of my oldest friends, but that doesn't come out right. So we're not old people, right? We're not old. No. Anyway, I'm just kidding. I've been friends with Chris for so many years. And Chris was actually one of the very, very first experts that I met. I was introduced to Chris by Dr. Andy Doan. And Chris, I don't know if you remember that very first phone call that we had with Andy. He's like, oh, you have to meet Chris. And we got on the phone. And I don't know if you remember, but when we were on that call, you started talking about attachment, touch, and movement for little kids. And I remember just being blown away because I had still my boys were still pretty small at the time. And all of a sudden, things started making so much sense to me the way that you described this. So we're going to talk about that for a few minutes today. And then we're going to go into the 10 things that you did an article on, reasons why kids between the ages of 1 and 12 or birth and 12 should not be running around with handheld devices in their hands. So we're going to talk about that. But let's start really quick with the attachment and touch and movement. Do you remember? I came up with this little way for me to remember it.
ATM. Yeah.
ATM. And you probably thought I was a little crazy, but I'm like, no, I have to have a way to remember this so I can tell all my friends that every day they need to get up and they need to think about ATM, like going to the ATM. At the time, I guess we had ATMs anymore. Everybody does their banking on their phone. So we could remember attachment, touch, and movement. This is what our kids need every day instead of more screen time. So talk about that for just a few minutes, Chris.
So as an occupational therapist of over 35 years now, I've really noted a change in our kids, and it started happening about 25 years ago with the advent of increased use of computers and in addition to TV. And then once we got the handhelds in 2010, everything just skyrocketed with usage rates. I practice a bit of a different approach to screen management. And what, as my background as an occupational therapist and a biologist, is what I focus on is there's four critical factors. So Melanie, I've added one more, nature.
Well, and I remember nature back then because we said that the ATM machines were always in nature.
That's
so
right.
Always outside. They were always outside.
To work that in there. But so there are four critical factors for a developing child, and children need lots of those when they're really young. Even as adults, we need these four critical factors in order to attain a child who's going to grow and succeed. So their movement, touch, human connection, and nature. So those four critical factors, if we focus as families on and schools on ensuring children get enough of that, then kids are automatically going to be using less screens, right? So instead of focusing on screen reduction, I focus on increased engagement in those four critical factors and have developed a concept called balanced technology management, which is my new website coming out. So we as adults are working to manage a balance between those four critical factors and child development. So when you look at brain development, body development, you really want to kind of think about growing a child is like building a house. It's all about the foundation. And those four critical factors, movement, touch, human connection, and nature, form a really solid foundation for our children. So lots early and, you know, taper off as they're moving through high school. But we still need to make sure that our kids get enough of those four critical factors every single day.
That is such a great way to put it. And I remember, and I still use this every day. I remember back when we first met, when my children were probably, the little ones were probably still in third grade or something. And it just, the light bulb just went on. It was such a great way to organize my parenting, if you will. Like what are we going to focus on? You know, what are we going to structure into our days? And that helped me so much to just remember that. And the thing you just coined the ATM and the nature thing. Every day when I would get up, I would think, okay, do my kids feel attached? Do they feel like are they getting touched enough? Are they getting enough movement? And have we been outside yet? And you're right. The minute you figure that part out and put what I call like the big rocks in, then the little stuff just kind of takes care of itself, because obviously screens don't help you meet any of these needs, right? So if your kids are in school all day and then they come home, you've still kind of a lot of work to do with these four things to, you know, there's not a lot of time to put them on a screen.
Yeah, because what parents really need to consider is that every time their child's on a screen, it's detrimental to body brain development, right? So we want to minimize that detriment, right? And we can do things like change content is going to minimize, you know, like the detriment, like pro-social programs, pro-social apps can actually build social skills. So it's not like all screens are bad,
right?
But right. We do need to stay under the durations that the American Academy of Pediatrics has put in place, which is nothing for the 0 to 2s, only an hour a day for the 3 to 5 year olds, 2 hours a day for the 6 to 12, 3 hours a day for the 13 to 18 year olds. So those are guidelines, you know, they're not rules that parents need to follow, but they're definitely guidelines put forward by our experts in this area who collate all the research showing detrimental effect, right, of screens on kids' development. So if we can keep that in the back of our mind and then start working on this concept of increasing access to those four critical factors to more healthy activities, then our kids are going to grow and succeed. If we don't engage in that, especially in the early years, we're definitely going to see some issues. which is what prompted me to write the 10 reasons why handhelds should be banned for children under the age of 12.
Which is what we're going to dive into. I'm so excited to run over all those 10 reasons. But just to close up this little thought, the way you described that to me at that time was so helpful because I needed some, like I knew the medical stuff behind it, you know, but I needed some practical action items. And I think back when our parents were raising us, they were doing all these things and they didn't even really know it, right? It just sort of happened. We ran around outside. We got lots of big hugs. There was a lot of movement, a lot of touch and connection. And so that it was happening without it being so intentional, but today we have to be really intentional. And I just want to let you know that those four things have helped so many families. So many kids have been changed because of you and because of your helping me understand. And then of course, in my work and all the workshops and all the stuff that we do through Screen Strong, your work is really reflected. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
We just have to have this practical help.
Definitely.
Yeah. So let's definitely then unpack the 10 reasons why handheld devices should not be, or should be banned for kids under 12. And what this article did, just explain a little bit about this article that you wrote, because I know you had like well over a million readers on this.
So this is back in 2013. So I got involved a long time ago in advocating for screen reduction and more of a balance between screens and healthy activity back in 2004. Like I'd been working as an occupational therapist in the school district in on the Sunshine Coast here in Canada, and noting a rise in some significant rise in problematic behaviors, in inability of the child to self-regulate, in difficulties with aggression, anxiety, depression. And, you know, I was thinking back, I never saw that when the origin, when I started working as a pediatric OT, never saw any of that. And I was thinking, why are our kids changing so much? So this is what got me involved in this area originally. And then I started seeing a massive change in 2010. So when we got the handhelds, which are the iPads, the iPhones, the, you know, any of the, anything that you can carry around. So I started really seeing a huge change and my referrals were going through the roof in the school system. So I left and I started collating research and I ended up writing my book, Virtual Child. And that was kind of the beginnings of starting to get pretty concerned about what was going on. But in 2013, Fisher-Price came out with something called the Aptivity Seat. And this is what I just, at that point, when I first saw it, it's the, you know, their little infant bucket seats that you know, use as, yeah, as a car seat when they're infants. What they've done is attached a iPad mount to that infant bucket seat, placing that pad right in the face of the infant. And yeah, I thought, there are so many things wrong with this. And I felt I had to start getting more of an advocacy, more militant, to try to educate parents on the dangers, the dangers of putting iPads in front of your child's face. So what this does in effect is it prohibits attachment, right? So attachment and human connection being one of those four critical factors. When a child, when an infant has a screen placed in front of them, they're bombarded with bright lights. They can't get away. They can't divert their gaze. They are drawn into this and they are occluded from any human connection with their siblings, with their parents. At that time, I thought, oh my God, we're going to see autism starting to fly through the roof. We know autism is an inability to socialize. It's a social disorder. And sure enough, now research is coining a phrase termed virtual autism, that we are actually seeing an autism that is directly related to how much screen time the infant had between the months of 9 to 18 months. So if infants have a lot of screen time and very little human connection. They're not playing with their family and their parents. They're not interacting. Then they are far more likely to be diagnosed with autism. And so I'm not saying that screens cause autism. It's the lack of human connection that right. is a causal factor in this type of autism. So there may be, and again, this is a very preliminary research at this point, there's two types of autism. The autism that we all know and that I've treated as a pediatric therapist for over 30 years. And then there's what we're seeing that could be related to screens. So I just thought, this is wrong. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to come up with 10 reasons. And I thought, you know, if I'm getting militant here, I'm going to use the word ban. And when I reviewed this with my colleagues, you know, everybody said, don't use the word ban, you know, and I thought, you know, I got to get out there and just do something a bit controversial, get people talking. I had no idea where it was going to go. Huffington Post approached me to write a second article. I'd written for them previously. They asked me if I'd do another article. It's okay, here we go. And so I came up with the 10 reasons to ban handhelds for children at the age of 12. I actually, and Melanie, if you agree with me, totally support it to this day. So when I wrote it in 2013, it was a bit of a, you know, let's just gather together the research. Let's back it heavily with research and see where it goes. But today, if I were to update all the research, there would be piles of citations under each of the 10 points.
That's a really good point. And, you know, Chris, it's very timeless because the truth never changes. It just doesn't change. These core truths that you're going to hear unpack for us today, they just don't change. And I mean, they get worse, but what you saw back then in the very beginning is exactly what's happening today. And I always say the smaller the screen, the more problems you're going to have. So I love the fact that you just say handhelds, because that is an iPad, it's a phone, it's the Game Boy, it's anything that kids can carry around with them and hold in their hands. And of course, you know, bigger screens aren't great either, but there's something about that handheld device, like you said, that just blocks out the rest of humanity from your kids.
Well, they're so impossible to manage. Right. A handheld is impossible to manage. With my kids are grown. I had issues with them with screens, but you know, Matt's 39 now, Katie's 27. But even with Katie, she was allowed to use the desktop computer in the house, which was in the den, which was facing outward. So if I was in the kitchen, I could actually see what she was on.
Right.
It was very easy to manage. When she turned 15, she got her first cell phone and her first laptop of her own. And then it was, you know, it was very difficult.
Game over. It was all over.
Up at night so she would sleep, you know, at a filing cabinet, and I'd lock, throw them in there and lock them up. Because I would get up in the middle of the night, how you kind of know as a parent, you're going, ah, what's going on? And then go check, and sure enough, there she was under the covers, you know, with whatever. So getting it out of the bedroom is crucial.
Well, and that's what makes all this really frustrating for parents. So we're so thrilled that you have actually put words around what is making us so frustrated. So let's start with the first thing. There's 10 things. We'll run through these pretty quickly, but you're going to be the perfect person to explain each one. So number one, rapid brain growth.
I'm not going to cite all the research studies that back each one of these 10. Otherwise, you'd be here forever. You can read it, right? And each of those research references are on my website in an area called a Zonin fact sheet. And they're organized topically, meaning so brain growth is its own section. And all the researchers are referenced alphabetically toward the end of the document. And you can link directly to that article. So just to let you know, if you really want to get the research, look on the fact sheet for the actual research. So the very first one, rapid brain growth, is it's absolutely crucial to understand brain development to really get the how screens are impactful on brain development. So when an infant's born, they're born with all their network of neurons in place. So think of a roadmap. All the roads are there. The neurons that are carrying the information to the different parts of the brain are all there so that every part of the brain, as it develops and grows, is going to be fed or serviced by a road. All the neurons are there. So two processes happen during the development of the brain. One of those is called pruning. What happens is the brain is very, very unique in that it doesn't like redundancy. It wants to be really, really efficient. So what it does is it prunes two-thirds of those neurons that that infant is born with. Two-thirds are going to be pruned over the course of the lifetime so that when that person dies in their, say, 60s or 70s or 80s, they will only have a third of those roads left. Now, what's really important to understand is the pruning happens in direct relation to the environment, what's going on in the environment. So the brain it will kind of say, oh my gosh, they're using this road, this neuron a lot. We're going to keep that one. But then it'll say, well, geez, we're not using, you know, an area like the frontal lobe very much. So let's just prune those tracts of the frontal lobe because this infant, this toddler, this child, this teenager is not using their frontal lobes, so they don't need the frontal lobe, is what the brain thinks. And this is exactly what we're seeing in children who overuse screens, is we're seeing areas of brain death or atrophy in the frontal lobes, because all this crap that they're watching, all this entertainment-based content, is not requiring frontal lobe to process.
Right.
It's a visual stimuli. Very active. The amygdala is very active processing this stuff. So what we're seeing is the child becoming more and more reactive, more and more, you know, they're less cognitive. They're not like thinking things through. They don't understand consequence to action. You know, they'll be like, why did you do this? I don't, you know, get it. Like, because they can't think. They basically can't think. We want to preserve tracks to all areas of the brain. We want to make sure that that child can use their whole brain when they need to, right? And that we're not seeing a poverty of neurons to the frontal lobes. That's really going to create a problem because that child won't understand how to control their impulses. You know, they'll be highly reactionary. They won't see the big picture. That, you know, they just won't get it. Just think of that poor child in school without frontal lobe or with a very impoverished frontal lobe. So that's pruning. The second process that happens is proliferation. So what we see is we see little dendrites growing in between the neurons. So for the brain to be really efficient, what it does is it kind of bypasses. Well, we don't have to go all the way to the end of that neuron. We can like create a little side road here. So there's a lot of proliferation that happens and pruning in the very young child. So in the 0 to 2 year old range, that brain triples in size. Not only are neurons being pruned heavily, but there's a huge proliferation of dendrites, connectors between the neurons. So that's why the American Academy of Pediatrics is nothing 0 to 2. We want that brain to be pristine and to maintain its development. So lots of movement, touch, human connection, nature, and no screen 0 to 2. So the 3 to 5s, again, you know, the process is slowing down a little bit, but it's still very, very active in the earlier years. So at the age of 12, and this is what backs why I said handheld should be banned, 0 to 12, is at the age of 12, 50% of this process, this pruning proliferation, has been completed. So if we can get our kids up to 12, right? And even like Katie, my daughter held her off till like 15. If we can get them as far as we can without screens, then we are doing a really good job. So does that mean they can't Skype with grandpa, grandma, or FaceTime? No. Does that mean, you know, that they can't watch a cartoon? No, keep it at the age appropriate limit, you know?
Right.
And even that 3 to 5 year olds, because of the rapid development, if you're going to get, you know, let them watch cartoons or mindless, you know, entertainment, then do 20-minute, you know, segments. Don't do it all at once. Right. Because what we find with self-regulation, and I actually did a study on this in schools, is if you just give them a dose, the younger ones, if you just give them a dose, they can come back to self-regulation. They can get their brain back quickly. But if you go over the 20 minutes, then you have a much harder time getting them off the whatever it is they're watching.
Yeah, right? 20 minutes, that's a really good rule. And I know for most parents, that's almost impossible because, you know, they don't want to get off and then they start whining and crying. And 20 minutes is really short. So
very short.
And they're going to do so much better just playing in the backyard. So that's okay. So that's the first one. So the second one is delayed development. So explain that one.
So kids need to move in order for their bodies to develop and their brains. Movement is very impactful on the developing brain. When kids are moving, their brain lights up, meaning that there's increased blood flow to the brain, increased processing, right? So I really advocate work a lot in schools, do a lot of workshops for schools and webinars now since COVID.
Yeah.
And so what we want to do is want to use movement to enhance cognition in the school setting. And we can do that by, why are kids sitting? You know, they should be standing. Let's get standing tables. Let's put them on wobble boards. Let's, you know, put TRX strapping and slam balls and all the, you know, these different sort of fitness based equipment in the actual classroom. And so we want to get those kids up and moving.
Yeah.
Now in homes, same thing, you know, convert your garage into a gym, convert a empty, you know, den or whatever, you know, put a chin up bar as you're walking into the den, you know, have a treadmill, have an exercise bike, is we really want to get these things into the homes. And kids love to play. So why not put a trapeze bar at the top of the stairs and they grab it and swing down the stairs and kind of drop off at the bottom, right? Why don't we put a set of rings if you've got something like a banister and you can attach them properly where they're safe? Why not let the kids play with rings,
yeah,
you know, put a mat underneath, right? So we really got to increase movement because when kids move, then all those motor units kick together. So just imagine when you're, there's two types of movement that we want to think about when we're looking at movement. One activates the something called the vestibular system. It's in the brain. It's referenced as your inner ear. And what that system does, it's different canals and different planes, it's got fluid, is when you're moving off center, that system activates and it says, come back to center. So think of a little child on a swing. They swing forward and that vestibular system says, girl, you're going to fall off the back of the swing. Better contract all the motor units on the front to keep you on the swing. And then you swing the other way and the reverse happens, right? So what happens with vestibular is that you build core. And think of it like a tree. You know, you want that tree trunk to be really strong. You want the roots to be really deep, right? So that the wind comes and it doesn't blow over, right? So we really want to activate that strong core. And when we activate vestibular, we also wake up the child. So any movement off center activates core. And it brings the child back to center. Once the child has core, they develop motor coordination. So the right side talks to the left side, the upper body talks to the lower body, the left eye talks to the right eye, which is essential for reading.
Mm-hmm.
The hand talks to the eyes, essential for printing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Spatial concepts are formed, essential for math. So vestibular is very important. Proprioceptive is the other movement system that we want to activate. And that happens when we engage in heavy work. So we want our kids to work hard. Because what happens is that builds muscle bulk, builds muscle coordination, and enables that child actually to drain energy. So while vestibular, that off-center movement, wakes kids up, when we give them heavy work to do, like go dig in the garden or carry the groceries in or sweep up those leaves in the yard, when we actually get them working, then it drains energy. So if we have really hyper kids, then we want to drain that energy. So those two types of movement are essential for translation into academics as well. I'm just going to keep going here. So number three is epidemic obesity. So in Canada and the U.S., in the U.S. it's 1 in 3, in Canada 1 in 4 children are overweight or obese. That directly relates to the amount of screens they're using, right? So if you're sedentary, obesity and then diabetes, our childhood diabetes are going to be more prevalent in that child. So we want to prevent that by getting them off those screens. And we know that a third of children who have obesity will go on to develop diabetes. Diabetes can cut 10 years off your life.
Right.
That it's actually very serious. So don't think, oh, we'll just change a child's diet, or, you know, they just have to take an injection once a day. It's a very serious disease. It affects their sight. It affects their nervous system. And it's not okay to have that. Number four, sleep deprivation is many of our kids are sleep deprived. If a child is allowed or teen to take a screen into their bedroom, they are going to be sleep deprived. And sleep deprivation directly impacts on health. A child who's sleep deprived has a 40% increased risk of cancer.
Wow.
And if they develop cancer, an increased risk of that cancer being malignant or tumor-based cancer. So this is something that we really, really have to make sure our children get enough sleep. And the only way, like with my daughter, that I could do that is lock up her stuff, right? You really need to get lock boxes, tech lock boxes, and there's a billion of them on, you know, different kinds or whatever. So I'm not going to go into that, but it's crucial that it gets locked up at night. And when kids wander off to different areas with their phones, so the bathroom, the bedroom, you have no idea what they're doing, right? And especially at night, if they have a screen in their bedroom, you have absolutely no idea who they're talking to or what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying don't trust your children, but let's exactly what you said, Melanie, let's just take daddy's shoes off right now.
Yeah.
And let them walk barefoot in their own shoes for a while, right? I start every workshop I do, I say, okay, so who here in this room, I want you to be perfectly honest, is in control of their screen.
Mm.
So who here would put up their hand and say, I'm in control. I control how much I'm using, what I'm watching, how long I watch it, blah, blah, blah. And very few people, I would say under 1%, put their hands up. So I'm speaking always to adults. So if less than 1% can control and manage their own screens, why are we giving them to kids, right? So they're not going, if you just say, oh, Johnny, turn your screen off, you know, at, you know, 9 o'clock. That's way too much, you know, control to give to a child, and they just can't manage. They can't possibly manage that. So number five, mental illness. We've seen a huge soaring rates of depression and anxiety and suicide in not only our teens population, but children. So you read that in the news practically every week. There's another child under the age of 12 who has attempted or completed a suicide attempt. Mm. This is something that is astonishing. And again, back to all my years, 35 years as an occupational therapist, I never, ever saw a child with mental illness 35 years ago. 25 years ago, I started seeing all the behavior issues. And then the soaring rates of child mental illness diagnosis. So ADHD, autism, depression, anxiety. There's a lot of anxiety in kids today.
Yeah.
There's so many studies that link this back to screens. In fact, I just read one yesterday about social media increases depression by 64%, you know, like over when you're using over a certain amount. So the 3 hour mark, right?
Yeah.
So this is something, again, back to the American Academy of Pediatrics, you know, respect the guidelines that they put in place.
And it's a linear increase. So it's, you use a little bit, you get a little depressed, you use more, you get more depressed. It's not like there's a certain thing even for teenagers that you can say, oh, well, if you use social media, if you're on your TikTok for only 45 minutes, you're not going to get depressed. It's a linear increase. So even just a little bit is going to affect them.
Well, and then too, Melanie, remember that conference we went to, the Children's and Screens Conference in New York? A speaker brought up the term differential susceptibility. Is every child's different. So every child has a different susceptibility mm-hmm. to the screens. So you might have twins, and you have twins, and you know they're not going to be the same in how much you know screen time they can tolerate.
Right.
So we may even have to put in different guidelines for our different kids based on their susceptibility to getting off the screens is really kind of what we want them to understand. But please note, and Melanie, I know you're great at pushing this, is that that this stuff, our kids love it. They want to be on it. They tell you that they need to connect to their friends. They need to connect to their friends. But it's what I call all breadth and no depth with this social media stuff. Mm-hmm. There's no depth in it. So the kids keep looking for, you know, recognition or, you know, attachment or connection with their friends, but they're not getting it. You know, they're like, what are you doing? No, nothing. What are you doing? Nothing. You know, they're not having in-depth conversations on social media. It's all snippets of little bits of this and that. And so it fuels the addiction because it fuels the seeking of connection. Yeah. And that's where it's so important, just before we move on to the next one, is that parents create time for human connection, right? Mm-hmm. So between, you know, like, let's just say dinners, let's say you're going to employ one little suggestion here is to have dinner together screen free. So dinner prep, dinner eat, dinner clean up, screen free. Screens are going to go in a basket. They're going to go in a drawer so that they're not out of sight, out of mind, right? And they're not going to be drawn to it. And that the family focuses on that human connection piece. How was your day today? Tell me one good thing that happened and one bad thing that happened. Let's go around the table. Mm-hmm. Let's actually eat at the table so that we're facing each other and not in front of a screen, right? And that can be a first step toward, again, this balanced technology management. Let's make sure we get that human connection in there every day. How are we going to do that? Well, it means no screens, because as soon as you have screens around, you are not connecting
right.
as a human. It's an interface that stops human connection. The kids need that human connection and they're seeking it with the device, but really they can get it with you as a parent better and fuller, and they'll get their needs met far more in the cohesive family unit than they will seeking it with all their buddies.
And when they're trying over and over and over to make this thing work, to make these shoes fit them, right? On the toddler example, they're trying so hard to make the shoes fit and they never will. They can't fit them at this stage. And so they get depressed. And this is where the mental health problems come in, because they're trying so hard to make this thing work, like you said, but it's not going deep enough. It's creating all these rabbit holes with all these other problems. So this is where the mood changes and all the depression comes in.
Parents need to disconnect from their screens. That is the number one step toward better screen management, is parents disconnect from your own screens and reconnect with your children. Put down the phone, pick up your child. It's really important that you make yourself available to your kids. Mm-hmm. So they know between the hours of 5 and 6 every night, they're going to have you to talk to. They're not going to go, especially if they're a teen, they're not going to go, oh, hey, great. Oh, I'm so happy we get to put our screens away. They're going to buck it. They're going to be mad. They're going to gripe. But you know what I noticed in my daughter one time? She was saying to her friend, oh yeah, my mom didn't let me use my screen, did that like that. And she turned to the side a bit and there was a smile. Yes. And I thought, oh my goodness.
She feels loved. You know? She feels loved when they have boundaries.
She was proud of me, but she sure as heck wasn't going to say that to her buddy. So please understand, parents, they are not going to welcome this. But our job as parents is not to pander to the whims and the, you know, whatever our kids want. Our job as parents is to say no. And in my workshops, I actually often will do this, not every time, but I'll just say, okay, so everybody, we're going to say no altogether. Okay. So I'm going to be the whiny child, right? And I'm going to be going, okay, they want my Give me my phone. And then I'll go 1, 2, 3. And everybody goes, no. And it's really pathetic usually at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's like, no. Right. And I push them until they're doing an emphatic no. Because as a parent, that's probably one of the most important words
you need to practice that more. Practicing.
Practice it with each other.
Okay, good. I'll practice that when I hang up. Okay.
So number six is aggression. We have known, my mother knew this. I'm 65 now, right? My mother knew this, is when she let us three kids watch the Three Stooges, we would start fighting with each other. She stopped letting us watch the Three Stooges, right? We have known this for decades, that violent media content creates an aggression in child, creates aggression in children. There's no adherence to this really by the video game developers, by, you know, our governments. So in 2010, there was a meta-analysis by Craig Anderson that looked at over 90 studies and proving that there is a direct connection, a causal link. So not an association, but a causal link between violent media content and aggression. So if you have a child who's talking back to you, you have a child who's hitting, who's punching, who's biting, who's very uncontrollable in that realm, stop the violent media content. Children, when I do tech talks in schools, I can't believe it. Kindergartners, yeah. You know, are playing Fortnite. And I'll say to them, you're supposed to be 13. Yeah. How old are you guys? Oh, you're 5. Okay, so let's do the math. I actually go to the board, we do the math, we count up to 13. That means you had, you know, it's 8 more years before you can play Fortnite. And they're stunned.
Yeah.
Because, and parents are stunned. And I have, I have some of the most problematic kids that I see are the ones who've gotten kicked out of, literally expelled from kindergarten because of violence,
oh,
right?
Oh my goodness.
And when I go and talk to them about what they're, you know, what they're playing, it's like GTA 5, I mean, just really, really violent content. Amazing what happens when you start unplugging them from that. So the seventh one, digital dementia, is, I've kind of talked a bit about that with the rapid brain growth, but we are actually seeing kids who can't remember their phone numbers, who can, you know, as a teenager, who were really seeing what can be termed dementia. So a regression, I call it the de-evolution of the human brain. Like we were designed to use that frontal lobe, right? To create connections and use that frontal lobe. When we don't use it, we are going to see huge problems with concentration, with memory, with attention. And it's exactly what teachers are struggling with today in school systems.
Yeah.
If kids can't do any of that self-regulation, that's all frontal lobe. So we are seeing, you know, what I term digital dementia, I have seen that in the research as well. We don't want to have, you know, our kids grow up with dementia. That's terrible. Anybody that has a grandparent or a parent with dementia knows how disastrous that can be.
No, this is a really good term. I mean, digital dementia is so perfect for this term, because just like you mentioned in the schools, when we are expecting this deep learning to happen and they're getting distracted every 2 seconds on their screen, that learning never goes deep. Their concentration, like you said, and their focus doesn't go deep. And so what happens? What you said earlier, the pruning starts to happen. So then now it's very difficult to go deep, right? Because the pruning has happened and you don't have the pathways to get you there. That's the science behind it. Yeah.
Exactly. And so that takes us right into number 8, which is addictions. If we don't have our frontal lobe functional, then we are going to be far more prone to becoming addicted to these devices. So in the absence of the fully engaged, attached parent, we are seeing children attaching to devices at an enormous rate, forming very unhealthy attachments to these devices. So as a parent, again, primary role there is as a functional attachment figure. So put down the phone and reconnect with your children. That's so crucial. The relationship you have as parents with each other, with your own parents, the grandparents, form a template from which that child will form their own relationships in the future. You want to be available to your children and form healthy attachments and relationships so that they will not form an attachment with the device. If you think about the device, it's there all the time. So it's really consistent. Mm. It's predictable. It's controllable. They can watch whatever they want, whenever they want, right? Mm. And then the device gets put down and they move into the real world and they have zero coping skills for the daily problems that we face as adults. They don't know how to cope. You know, why can't I control everything? How come nothing's predictable? How come, you know, yeah. I can't do what I want when I want to do it? They don't learn how to wait. They don't learn how to take their turn. Screens teach them that they are the most important thing in the world and they are there to be entertained by the screen, right? And that's what it's all about, right? Well, the real world is not like that. So this brings, I'm going to jump to number 10 and then I'll go back to number 9. This really brings back what I've said for years and years and years. It's the ways we're raising and educating our kids with screens are not sustainable. We are not creating a child who's going to grow up and who's going to have good relationships, functional relationships, get a job, finish school, possibly go on to post-secondary. We're creating something really different. We're creating a very, very unhealthy human being, unhealthy physically, unhealthy mentally, and without any skills whatsoever to move out there in the world. So we're seeing far more kids just stay in the home upon graduation, and if they do graduate, and parents are somehow okay with this. Like, I was like, as soon as my kids hit into grade 12, I was like, oh God, I hope you're leaving. You know, that's what we should be doing as parents. We should be creating independent children who are healthy, who want to leave at 18 and go out in the world and create their own lives. You know, we don't want to have this kid in the basement playing video games or on social media all day that doesn't have a job, who is extremely unhealthy and has obesity and diabetes. And because I see more and more and more of that. And I see the parents saying things like, well, at least I know where they are.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I'm thinking, is that the most important thing, to know where your children are? I mean, not at the age of 18, no. You know, even at the age of 16, 17, they should be getting, you know, pretty independent and, you know, and making their own decisions and cooking for themselves. And yeah. I mean, Melanie, you've always said this is that they, before they get a handheld, they should be able to, you know, wake themselves up in the morning. Let's look at all the functional things, yeah. Get themselves dressed, make their breakfast, make their lunch, get themselves to the bus without having you yell at them all the time, you know, and they should be doing their chores, a couple chores a week or whatever, you know. Is we're not raising that kind of child. These screens are creating dependency.
No, it's children. They have no life skills, like you said a minute ago, and they're failing to launch. And so it's really easy, because everything that a parent needs to raise a healthy child is under their own roof, right? And it's free. It's the backyard. It's the chores. It's all of these executive function skills that need to be developed before we hand them the handheld, which is going to give them the skewed view of what life is like, because life is not like a screen. But we're training them. I mean, I thought it was really interesting that you just said that it's consistent, it's predictable, and it's controllable. And when we can start teaching our kids to put that down, or we can't teach them to put it down. We just have to take them and put them somewhere for them. And until they can start learning these skills in real life, you won't win this battle. The battle will be lost, and they will be the victims of it, because we didn't do what we needed to do when we needed to do it, because there is a window. And that's the one biggest thing I've learned from you in all these years, is that there's just this window of time that we have, because once they turn 17 or 18 or 19 or 20, or if you have the 25-year-old living on your sofa, it's very difficult to reverse. It's very difficult to go back and do all these things that really needed to happen during these early years.
And Melanie, you brought up, you used the term launch. So parents, there's two jobs that parents have through the development of 0 to 18. And the first one is to provide a safe haven for their children. They need to create security, safety, and help their children feel loved and cared for, right? So you do a lot of that when they're first born, right? You know, it's all about safe haven, creating, you know, predictable patterns and routines. But it's really about making sure the child feels safe, and you're doing a lot of care for your child, right? You know, diapers and feeding and, you know, a lot of care. Without you, they would die, right? And so they require a lot of that safe haven. But at some point, you want to start creating some what we term launch. This is in attachment, John Bowlby's attachment theory, is the second job of the parent is actually to launch the child into the world for self-exploration, for development of independence, for creating, again, these patterns which they're going to live, you know, the whole rest of their lives, right? Mm-hmm. So at some point, you start doing less of the safe haven, a bit more of the launch, right? Mm-hmm. But also always going back to safe haven. So when child's upset, you know, they come back, they should feel comfort in the parent and the parent's arms around them and the phone away. And, you know, but what I'm seeing today is this failure to launch is that parents are not focusing on launch. They're not thinking, oh my gosh, at 18, they should be leaving the house and going off to do what, you know, live their own lives. Is parents are clinging to their children. And this texting with their children constantly is hugely impactful on creating a dependent relationship. And parents, please understand that this is about your insecurities and your need to be needed, that you're creating this dependency in the child. And it's very, very damaging to children. And many children that I know, when they hit 18, they were out of there and they were like, I'm not texting with you at all anymore, yeah. Right? They created their own rules around, you know, so you're damaging your own relationship with your child, but you're also damaging the relationship that child has with other people in their future life. So stop with the texting. So the very last one here, I should probably have made the first one because it's the most important. And it's the one that we don't understand very much about, but the research is telling us we really have to start listening, is that all these wireless devices emit radiation. And that's how they talk to each other, right? That's how our phone talks to our router. That's how we pick up signals. So iPads, iPhones emit a significant amount of radiation that is actually over what the government guidelines have set. And this is you kind of say, well, why aren't our health governments moving forward with initiatives to educate and help us to understand more about this? It's too early. It took 10 years when they first started figuring out that medical radiation was harmful to a developing fetus. It took 10 years to enact legislation that you had to put a lead shield over a pregnant mother when she was getting her dental x-rays. And then it went into, well, let's just put it over everybody when they're getting their dental x-rays, right? So it takes a lot of time, takes a lot of evidence. But just to recap quickly, in 2011, the World Health Organization categorized wireless radiation as a 2B carcinogen. And that what that means is it has, there is a potential for it to be dangerous. So that was 2011. In 2018, NIH had their National Toxicology Program released findings showing causality with two different types of tumors. One was a brain glioma and one was a heart schwannoma. That in and of itself, that was experimental data based on rats and mice. But that in and of itself should have woken all of us up. When that came out, I was thinking, oh my God. And then it went to independent review, came back with even more strict guidelines and warnings. So we're not being told this. Mm-hmm. And what we need to understand is, again, let's go back to brain and body development. So we have our little infants who are, their bodies are have a lot of water in them. They're more aqueous. So the radiation penetrates easier into a smaller child. Their skulls are thinner. And the third thing is they have a higher cell turnover, a higher rate of cell turnover. So we don't want to damage those cells. We don't want to damage the DNA of those cells. We want to actually, again, look at that developing infant and toddler and child as we want to create pristine environments for these children. So we really, the more you move away from a phone or a, you know, wireless device, the further you move away, the lower the radiation. So every inch you move away from your cell phone decreases the radiation by 10%. So me, I'm sitting here at my desk right now. I don't even know where my phone is. You know, I think I left it in my bedroom. I have a pattern of not knowing where my phone is most of the time, right?
Yeah.
But if I am at my desk and I'm doing work and I need to be on my phone, I put it an arm's length away. Mm-hmm. I have my den rigged for wired devices. So I have a direct plug-in to, remember those Ethernet plugins?
Yeah.
And you too, it's in your homes, if you have young children, if you are pregnant, do not put the device on your child, you know, in utero. So, you know, most people, and especially like with early infants, breastfeeding, you know, is this, oh, I can do my emails or I can go on Facebook or whatever. Keep that device away from that little baby. And that's a time to be connected to your child. You may think, oh, they start to suckle and then they go to sleep, you know, like what's the point or whatever. There's a huge point.
Yeah.
You're looking at that beautiful, beautiful, pristine little child that you've just birthed, and you don't want to muck with their biology. And you want to try to be there for them when they open their eyes. You want them to see you looking at them and not at a screen, because that's just, it breaks human attachment. So it's a very important one, the wireless radiation piece. We're going to hear more in the years to come. And what I encourage people to do is proceed with caution. Mm-hmm. I spoke at a conference in Reykjavik, Iceland, who's, by the way, Europe is far more advanced in France in putting measures in place to protect our children than we are in North America. You know, we develop what's termed the precautionary principle, and that with developing brains and bodies, we want to really restrict use and exposure to these potentially harmful wireless radiation. Actually, I can't say that anymore. It's not potentially harmful. It's been proven.
It's proven
to be
harmful,
and it's not been proven to be safe.
Wow.
So this is something that we really have to push our governments toward is, okay, so prove to me that it's safe.
Right, right.
Because there's a lot of evidence showing that it's not.
Well, this has been just so just so much information here in such a short amount of time. You just packed it in. I've been taking notes like my crazy. I have 5 pages, I think, of notes here. Thank you so much. We will have this article and this list in the description of this podcast. So be sure and look down there for the different websites and the links. But Chris, just before we leave, what can you tell the parents that are listening? Just a final word of encouragement is what I always ask my guests when they come on. But there are moms and dads out there listening that they may be new to this issue. They may have 2-year-olds, or they may have a 15, 16, 17-year-old that they're just reaching for the Kleenex right now because they realize that their development is not where it needs to be and they have a lot of work to do. And this can just be so hard for parents. What can you tell them to encourage them? What are your final words of encouragement here?
Well, probably the first thing I'd say is get it out of the bedrooms at night. If there's one thing you're going to do, I'd say that's the most important thing, is that, and anything wireless, especially like baby monitors and that sort of thing, is get the stuff out of their bedrooms, make the bedroom a pristine place, and adults, you too, where bedrooms are for sleeping and for having sex and, you know, but they're not for watching your phone, you know, into the early hours of the morning. So get the stuff out of the bedrooms, then really start thinking about, okay, so this movement, touch, human connection, nature, how can we start carving out some time in our busy week where we're actually actively engaged in that? So you might want to think about that dinner hour thing, an hour a day where it's screen free. You might want to think about, why don't we just totally unplug on Saturday? Okay, Saturday's a busy day. We're going, you know, to the soccer games. We got to go get groceries, got to do laundry, got to clean rooms, got to whatever. Like, let's throw it in the lockbox, you know, for the whole day on Saturday. So I say an hour a day a week, and then I really can push for a week a month now, or sorry, a week a year, hour a day, day a week a year, that you go screen free. So try a family holiday screen free for a week. Start as a family looking at possibly unplugging even for a weekend. You know, so start with the hour around dinner, and then, you know, maybe do a half day on Saturday, and then bump that up to a full day on Saturday. But pack it with healthy activities. Don't just kind of say, okay, so we're all locking up our screens and then stand there and look at each other, right?
Right.
Really, you know, we're going to the beach, we're going for a hike, we're going swimming, we're going to go visit grandma, we're going to, you know, once COVID restrictions come down, it hopefully soon that it's going to open up the door. And that's a wonderful thing to think about right now, is that, you know, everywhere across the globe, we've been through a horrific time, and we're now kind of almost on the other side, and maybe things are never going to go back the way they were, but we are going to be able to start opening the door and going out and seeing our friends again. So make that a priority. Make friends and family a priority, and screen free, you know, it would really, really, really help. And I know that on that Melody's website has a screen strong challenge, where families can actually plan ahead and do a 1 week unplug. And there's a lot of resources there that will help them along the way. So what happens with these unplugs is that you can reset the brain to be more calm, to be more relaxed, to be less reactive. And doing that together as a family is fantastic. So check out Melanie's Screen Strong Challenge on her website.
Thank you, Chris. You're right. That really does work. All these things that you just mentioned, and then also just taking time away helps families really reset. We can't worry about all the things that we haven't done. We can only start with today, right? So I love your advice. Just tonight, get everything out of the bedroom, right? That's something that families can do right now. Carve out time this summer for family dinners. You know, Chris, one thing that I'm a real big fan of is trying to see how many of these things we can do all at once, like the ATM in nature and all that. So you can take your family dinner out in the backyard, have a picnic, so you're in nature. Don't bring any screens outside, right? And you can have a lot of touch and attachment and connection and time to talk to your kids and just spend time with your kids. So thank you so much for all of this today. We have learned so much. I'm just thrilled to get you on here finally. So thank you, Chris, so much for sharing.
You're very welcome. And thank you for everything you do, Melanie, to help families. It's awesome.
Well, you've been out there longer than so many of us, and we depend on your knowledge and your wisdom and your research. Much of the research that we have on our website, you have helped put that together. So thanks so much for all the collaboration that we have. So I hope you enjoyed listening today. Head over to our website to donate and learn more about the Screen Strong Challenge that Chris was just talking about. Also, make sure to join our Screen Strong Families Facebook group, where you will find support from other parents just like you. And remember to subscribe, rate, and share this podcast with your friends. Remember, we've got your back and we are here to help you. So until next time, stand up for your kids, stand out from the crowd, and stay strong.